Workflow automation is an important companion to event streaming systems. Bernd Rucke, co-founder of Camunda, has been involved with it from the start of his career. He joins me today to talk about the space, including the fairly sophisticated trade-offs between orchestration and choreography. It's all on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I am joined in the virtual studio today by Bernd Rucke. Bernd is the co-founder and chief technologist of a company called Camunda. Bernd, welcome to Streaming Audio.
Tim, thanks for having me.
You bet. Hey, you know, I always like to ask every guest, not just what do you do, you're always better at giving that account than I am, but how you got to be doing that. So what are you up to and how did you get into it?
Okay. So if we start with what I'm up to, it's basically I'm kind of a workflow automation addict. So I'm doing things with workflow automation for basically a decade or so. So this is how I basically got started my working life. So even during high school, I helped a friend with setting up his business, which was kind of a graphic cards online ordering thing back in the days. And I helped him getting the IT sorted out and wrote a program for doing so. And this got me hooked up with, how I can make the whole business process work in that scenario. How can I sketch it? How can I discuss it? How can I implement that? And that pretty much got me into that ecosystem, which is really surprising for myself as well, never left so far. So over that, I got hooked up with, back in the days, an open source framework around workflow automation. And that basically led me into that community. And then I started to give trainings around that. And I started to visit a lot of customers doing things with it. And I really got excited by the whole workflow automation topic. And this is somehow how I got into that. And relatively soon in that journey, I started the company, like Camunda, which is there now as well, beginning of 2008. And this was the whole beginning.
And tell us about the company a little bit. You started as a consulting company. You know, it's 2008, you're a workflow automation expert, you've used the tooling, you've been doing nothing but this your whole career. So that makes sense. But tell us about the history of the company since then.
Yeah. So I think the fun part is 2008, I wouldn't call myself an expert in workflow automation. I think at the beginning, I was quite good at starting to do things and talk about it. So I got engaged in a lot of projects. And you're right, it was purely a consulting company. We co-founded, we founded with two people, my co-founder and me. And we started to do consultancy around workflow automation. BPMN started to be a thing. That's the, now it's an ISO standard as a notation to model workflows and execute them. By then, it's just started out. And we really got hooked up with that and started to give trainings around that, wrote a book about that. And that helped us really to gain some momentum in that community, especially in the German-speaking community in the beginning. So we're based in Germany, and that's a smaller market to start with, which I think is a good idea in the beginning. And that, over the years, basically 4 or 5 years, we had a lot of contacts with different companies. Very often we're 3 days training, 4 days workshop, a review thing and whatever. But we have hundreds of them. So we saw a lot of companies from the inside, and we saw which tools they were using, which technologies they were using, and what worked and what didn't work. And that basically led us to understanding also the market and the gap in the market at that time. So there were either very big vendors like the IBMs and Pegas doing workflow automation, or BPM, BPMS, as it was called at the time. And there were relatively low-level open source frameworks, which normally also couldn't cut it. And we saw an opportunity in the middle where we say, okay, we need something which is really developer-friendly, which is open source, which is simply available, but also really brings the whole power of the ideas around BPM and workflow to the people. And that's what we did. So beginning of 2013, we transformed the whole company into an open source vendor. basically, and that's where what we are now. So
and you're still bootstrapped at this point. That is, you're financed by revenue that's not venture capital.
So we're
2013.
Right. We totally bootstrapped with our own money. That was pretty much, it was a good move. I could never repeat it in my life probably because we really collected a lot of money over the consulting engagements. But yes.
And those are not easy.
It was not easy, no. I mean, it got kind of easy over the time, but I mean, you have to work in consulting, you have to work for every hour. You get money for. So no, it's not easy. And you can't scale it easily. I mean, it's not like you're bringing the next person, you can send it out for big money and he will product it from day one. That's not how consulting works, especially if you're kind of doing expert consulting.
Right.
Yeah.
So with that, what is workflow automation and how does it differ from business process management? You mentioned BPM, and I want to just give my context here. My first exposure to this whole thing and you know, the open source ecosystem of workflow automation / business process management was good old JBPM in, I don't know, 2003. it was a lot of XML. It didn't feel good. I mean, it was, not to insult the project. This was a brand new thing that people were doing for the first time. And you know, nothing is ever easy to use the first time out of the gate. And we were all sort of high on XML at the time for reasons I don't think historians will ever fully, catalog. So it didn't feel good back then. But that was my first experience with it. And so what's that? How's it different from workflow automation? And what is workflow automation?
Totally. So it was even the same, I think, how I started. So I got also hooked up with JBPM back in the days. I think if it was 2003, it was JBPM 2, which was really kind of painful. Go a long way since then.
Yes.
But it was the same thing. As you said, I started with that as well, but it was very, very low tech. And it's actually not easy to sort out the terms because different people really use different terms for the same thing. So first of all, the term business process basically means it's a business process. It's a workflow. I don't see a big value of distinguishing the terms. But very often, as soon as people say business process, developers very often think of like, oh, that's kind of a low-code BPM solution kind of a thing. That's what most people connect to the term BPM nowadays. Like the big vendors I mentioned earlier, like IBM, Pega, Software AG, and so on and so forth. Over basically a couple of years, they tried to sell the idea of zero code or low code, which basically means, hey, your IT is too slow. They don't understand your requirements or whatever. So you should do it yourself. You should have the business people drawing the business processes and clicking together everything that's necessary and put it live immediately. Which
it's going to work this time. This is the generation that's going to make that work.
We promise this time it works.
Yes.
Exactly. And yeah. I mean, that burned the topic for a lot of people, actually.
Yes.
So especially in development or in IT departments, because what normally happens is you get that tool onto your desk because surprise, surprise, the business didn't do it themselves. So, and then you're locked into kind of a proprietary environment. You're having that whatever IDE, you can't use your typical IDE. You can't use, probably not even code, software development. You can't test it. You can't CI/CD it,
right.
And so on.
Or
so forth.
Maybe there'll be some generated Java code on the back that you could theoretically look at, but that's like reading an H.P. Lovecraft short story. You know, you're going to like run screaming into the night.
Correct. Yes. And that, I think that's the experience most people had with BPM. And that's why I personally, at the moment, at least, try not to use the term too much, even if I think it's still kind of an accurate term. And I could probably even imagine it coming back because at the moment, a lot of people start talking again about process automation in a way. So we might get it back. Let's see.
It's like the Winnie the Pooh meme where you've got just regular Winnie the Pooh and that's business process management. Then you've got Winnie the Pooh with the top hat and the monocle and that's workflow automation.
Kind of
the same thing, but one prefers the latter term.
That's, yeah, that's pretty much how it is. I work around it by saying like business process automation is kind of what you do. It's kind of the goal. And I see workflow automation as kind of the tool to get there. So kind of a workflow engine, for example, is the concrete software component you're using. And that's just called a workflow engine. And that's kind of fine. I get around with that at the moment. So
now, and another thing that I'd like to dig into with you for just a minute, since this is your line of work, and this is a little bit of a pet philosophical thing for me. This just occurred to me, by the way. First of all, it's okay. Nobody has to write code. We're just going to draw pictures and the business people can capture the processes. Like if you're a second generation software developer, the funny thing is, and you're saying that right now, your mother or your father was saying that before you were born. You know, there were tools then. And maybe if you're a third generation software developer, maybe your grandmother or your grandfather was saying that, talking about COBOL, you know, because that was the whole idea that it's so much like English that, you know, business people and, you know, SQL, people could just type these things out, you know, that we have this like siren song, this thing that calls us that we can't resist going to, saying that, no, we're going to make some tool that's going to allow us to make programs that, don't need programmers. You know, regular people will be able to do this. And I think, and I just want to put this idea out here and get you to respond to it, but I think your specialty, you know, what Kamunda does, your open source project, the thing that you have dedicated your life to, I think this is one of the areas that most crisply demonstrates, number one, that initiative fails over and over and over again. And I think why it fails, because the things you're trying to model, okay, like I got my start as a firmware developer in the 90s, and I'd like, you know, write some firmware that would configure a modem and do some little light, super lightweight signal processing and stuff like that. And all those processes that you're writing code to describe are, they're mathematical abstractions, right? You're writing code to do math. And that's not easy, but the mapping the math into the code feels very natural. Right. There's no, it's what computers do. When you've got a business process, well, you got to think, what is a business process? That's a bunch of human beings. That's a social system of these interactive agents, these people who are not fundamentally mathematical. They're not fundamentally mechanical. Their experience is fundamentally mental, right? They think about things and they speak in human language and they have ambiguity and they have implicit knowledge and they, you know, when things go wrong, they just kind of know what to do and they make it right. And so all the world of business of people interacting is all like that. And people carry out their business processes once they're good at them without even thinking. You know, they just do it and they can chew gum and they can gossip and they can surf the web and to some degree and still do all this business process management mentally. But now when we try to make that into software, suddenly it's incredibly difficult and it requires we call them programmers, you know, specialists who can convert that mental phenomena into mechanical steps. And so I see what you do as trying to make that conversion easier. But it sounds like you're acknowledging it's okay, business people are just going to draw diagrams. And that's how it be the tools. It sounds like you're acknowledging that that's not really the way forward.
Okay, that was a kind of a long question. And it's
I'm just kind of saying, it's not really a question, but like, you know, what do you think of that way of looking at the world?
I think there are a couple of things which are interesting with that observation. So first is, yes, I mean, in a way, it's like business process management or especially the workflow models, which normally are expressed graphically, not for all the tools out there, but for us, for example, they're expressed graphically. They are indeed that help for the humans to understand or to express or to discuss workflows. Like, how does that work? What, like, what's the sequence of steps required to get there?
And that's like a block diagram.
Kind of a block diagram. And funny enough, I mean, the one thing that's very obvious is when you're discussing requirements, like, hey, how should that work? Then this is very helpful. But a big observation is also that this is super helpful during operations, for example. If something fails, you want to see, hey, what were the last steps? What will be the possible next steps that are currently blocked by? So what's the context of things when I'm in that failure? It's also like, I mean, as a customer, for example, if you call in and say, hey, my whatever my order does not yet arrive, probably you somebody on the other end need that kind of context as well to understand what's currently going on. So I totally agree with that one. And by the way, I think that that's probably special for these kind of workflows. So my definition of a workflow is I have a sequence of activities, and they can be what I call potentially long running. So you might have to wait. It can be a human, but it can be another system, like a whatever. Could be an asynchronous message that you get back at a later point in time. So whenever you have to potentially wait in these steps, that's for me as a workflow. And this sequence is very natural to express in a graphical model. That's, I think, different to I'm really writing kind of an algorithm, or I'm writing some dedicated function to make something happening. But a sequence of activities where I potentially have to wait, it's very natural to draw as a diagram. That's, I think, totally, why it works totally very well.
So I wouldn't mean to suggest that drawing it out is bad. It's the repeated. Yeah. I think all you have to do is draw it.
Right, and I think that was probably the mistake done in the past. Sometimes I think even deliberately by the vendors. So why it works for our customers so well is that we say, okay, you express certain elements of your, let's say, business logic, like the sequence of steps in that business process diagram, for example. And then whenever you have other elements, like whatever you want to call an API, you want to send out an event on Kafka or write a record to Kafka, then you just use whatever you use, like programming. And then you connect these two very easily. You say, okay, but behind that box lives that code, but it's code, it's normal code. It's like you write it in any other program. And that combination, that makes it very powerful. And that in the past, that was typically not the case for the big BPMS. They tried to put everything behind a wizard that it can click it together, and that simply didn't work. But it works very well if you connect the both worlds properly.
If you make it, it sounds like kind of from a worldview perspective, as you approach this, you're saying, totally, diagrams, draw it out, block diagrams, there's a sequence, it helps to visualize that sequence, make that drawing a first-class citizen of the automation tool, but the code is also a first-class citizen of the tool.
Correct.
And so you get to write that code using maybe standard frameworks in a way that's testable. You sort of get to approach it as a civilized person.
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly. And even like the diagram, I mean, if you look at BPMN, for example, it's, I'm sorry for that, XML again. But I mean, normally that's not a big deal. It's an XML file, and that can even live in your normal version control. It can live in your normal whatever you have product. So it's really part of your development product. It's not an alien there.
Exactly. If it fits natively into a Git repo, then we can make jokes about XML. That's fine. It's just that's not real. go ahead, make it JSON. Go, make it YAML. Is it real? Is your life really better? It's not.
I had that conversation once with a big company in Silicon Valley company where they literally said, it's nice, but we can't use it. We can't give XML to our developers. It's totally legacy. So some people do that, like on that level.
But YAML, we can, and
yes,
we're not
course.
Sure why. So that's hey, pretty much all of our text file formats are bad for one reason or another, and
totally.
Yet we soldier on.
Let me add one other thought before I forget it, and that's you said I even misunderstood, but it's a good opportunity to mention that anyway. You talked about human beings and business processes, and one thing that I see people also having a wrong picture of workflow automation is that workflows are not necessarily a lot about humans. I mean, humans have to implement them in order to get them automated, but we have a lot of customers which really what's normally named straight through processing, which really fully automate some workflows. So
that's a really good point.
There might not even be a human involved in the whole workflow.
This reminds me of Jay Kreps's keynote at the Kafka Summit last September. Yeah, it was September in San Francisco, Kafka Summit 2019. And he talked about this precise contrast. So the previous wave of automation was computer programs that helped people do their part of a business process better, rather than a filing cabinet, a typewriter. You know, you had CRUD in a database. But current wave of automation is really automating different computer programs that are cooperating to work out a business process. And there are people kind of around the edges of those. But like you just said, it's software interacting with software.
Correct. Correct.
Yes.
I mean, you always have the, and that's sometimes a good opportunity. You always have the possibility to create something like a human task. It might only be in the, like, something is wrong case, but that means normally you can concentrate on the 80% case of automating, like, the happy path. And whenever something is weird, you just, like, pass it on to a human. So that's relatively simple with workflow automation, but still, you automate most of the things anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes there is an input from a human that is improperly formatted or does not validate in some way. And so some service along the way throws an exception. And well, that now needs to be presented to a person to manage the exceptions. They can make sense of it. But otherwise, you've just got things talking. That relates very much as an aside to the idea of dead letter topics in Kafka. That's a thing that comes up. I'm sure you've seen it a million times, but you know, some people take very doctrinaire approaches, like, well, every topic has to have a dead letter topic in case a message can't be processed. And you know, my guidance is always don't create a so-called dead letter topic unless there's a user interface and a process whereby a human being can deal with that exception, or you have some way of, you don't just have it there just in case. It has to be the kind of thing that you'll deal with.
Correct. Yeah, I totally agree. And that's, I think that's for dead letter queues or dead letter topics. And the big challenge is that whenever something goes in there, you really have to understand what just happened. What's the context of that? Where does it come from? And we see a lot of projects very often struggling with that. That's one of the things where I think workflow has the advantage there, where you can see, okay, where does it come from? Why is there a failure? And you have kind of a, in Kimono it's called incident, but it's kind of, let's say, the dead letter queue for one activity that's always built in. So because you're stateful, you can always stop at one point in the workflow, wait there, and say for some operator, hey, here was a problem. This is the whatever exact stack trace. That's the variables we have. Sort it out. And that's one of the big advantages I see there.
Nice. It occurs to me I stated that, and I honestly should have asked that as a question, because I am talking to a guy who spent his life in workflow automation. So
no, it's fine.
It's good to know that the advice I give there is advice that you endorse, because you'd know. That gets us into, though, the orchestration choreography tension. And I think you had submitted a talk for Kafka Summit London on this, yes?
Correct.
Yes. And unfortunately, because of COVID-19, there wasn't a Kafka Summit London. But I was personally excited about that. I love the topic, and I think that's a very clarifying distinction. So talk to us a little bit about, maybe you didn't write the whole talk, but what did you intend to cover there?
Oh, that's a good question, because I didn't like flesh out the talk, to be honest.
I'm with you there. As a conference speaker myself, maybe once or twice I've written an aspirational abstract and thought, hey, I bet I could write a good talk on something like this. And
I'm pretty sure, actually. And I got it accepted for, I think, 3 conferences, but all of them were canceled. So simply didn't flesh out the slides. But content-wise, I'm pretty clear on what I wanted to talk about. And it's basically, probably we should briefly introduce orchestration choreography. I'm not sure if everybody on the podcast is like familiar with that.
Please define those terms. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's try. I mean, you can add your view on that. So for me, choreography is always a bit like you have different components and they emit events. And if some component or another, if they need to interact, another component reacts on the event of the other. So I always make the example of order fulfillment, for example. So you could have a component where you check out an order, like a web page or a shop or whatever it is. And that could like push an event on a bus, for example, says, hey, there was an order placed. And then if somebody else, some other component reacts on that, for example, to collect the payment for that order, that's a choreography because they're kind of choreographed. Nobody tells the payment to do something, it reacts on the event. That's for me one of the defining characteristics. Orchestration for me is whenever I tell somebody else to do something, I orchestrate the other components. So for example, you could have an order fulfillment microservice that like says to the payment service, please collect the money for that specific order for me. Then it's orchestrated. And that's for me the big difference in these two concepts. Like either it's purely event driven and the other one, I command somebody else to do something.
That's exactly how I look at them. I mean, you can look at the disciplines that the words come from. Orchestration is a bunch of people playing concert music. And those people are not so much free agents. They have each one of them has a plan that they're following. It's not jazz, you know, they don't get to innovate. And there is a conductor who is really keeping time. You know, there's a shared plan that everybody's going to do, but they're really looking to the conductor to make sure that they do the right thing at the right time. And that conductor is, in a sense, orchestrating all of the people. And the choreography one, I love what you said. And it helps my wife and I took dance lessons for 4 or 5 years, a number of years ago. And there's just so much that you can learn there that I think that helps illustrate the idea of choreographed services. Cause we did it was ballroom and Latin dance were the things that we did. And so, I would lead and she would follow. And the thing is in a dance, you know, there's a particular kind of dance. So there's kind of a grammar. There are certain things that you're able to do and a little bit of a syntax. You can do this kind of thing after that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of a language there. You're not just walking. It's not just free form movement. It's very structured. But like when the person leading, say, moves in a certain way that makes a space that the person following is supposed to move into, the person following then moves into the space. You know, the leader doesn't move the person. You don't like reach out and make sure, okay, now you're going to step here, you know, grab and, or, you know, you don't do anything to make sure that happens, but the other dancer is a free agent and gets to make, in this case, her decision about whether she's going to move into that space you made. And so, you know, one person leads, the other person responds or doesn't respond. And so you've got this idea of, sure, there are rules and there's a set of things that you can do and can't do, but you're making decisions and everybody else is making their own decisions. Your dance partner is making her own decisions about what she's going to do.
Yeah. I think this is the typical picture that very often comes up also in slides. And this is actually a pity because I think this doesn't work on a podcast because I have a slide on that as well. But I have a third type of dance there, which is kind of a pogo dance, because that's for me what I've seen a couple of companies running into. If they embrace that choreography fully, and that's what I've seen a couple of companies doing like over the last like 5 years, it's as always, they see that new tool like event driven. Oh, event driven is cool. We want to embrace that 100%. Everything needs to be event driven. And then they have this full choreography and having a lot of services which interact in that, let's say, event driven way, makes it really hard to understand the whole system, makes it really hard to control. And that's kind of, that's why I use that pogo dance where it's like, it's really hard to manage. It's sometimes really hard to understand it. And that's what I tried to make the point with that talk, actually. So I think there are a lot of use cases for choreography or event-driven coupling. It's basically a coupling topic. Like, I have two components interacting, so they are coupled in some way. And the belief is that event-driven reduces the coupling. And I don't believe in that. I think there are cases where that's true. So in some cases, you might be better off using some kind of event-driven coupling. But in some cases, you might still want to use orchestration or commands in order to get something done. And you have to find the right balance between two. You have to decide that on a case-by-case basis. So there's not like a one-size-fits-all solution to that. And I think the main point why people are not really following that way, or why they are concerned following that, is that whenever I say orchestration, they think of some kind of, let's say, central spider in the web. That's probably, again, rooted in failures of the BPM era in the past, where it's very often like we have that central BPMS system sitting there and everybody has to talk to that, and the central ESB and whatever. So everything
was centralized. There's an ESB in there somewhere, right?
Of course, of course. That was a blueprint for every architecture, a BPM system, a ESB, and then we have that SOA services. And that was very central, and the central part did not work, because central is just not going to work in any bigger corporation normally. And now people say, okay, orchestration doesn't work. And this is just not true. You can do orchestration, it's probably not the right word, but you can do it very local. So you could have like one service, one microservice, for example, and let's say the order fulfillment. And that probably needs to orchestrate two or three other services, like, hey, I need payment now. When the payment is done, hey, I want to whatever, trigger shipment. And this is orchestration, but it's very local.
Okay. I appreciate the maturity of that perspective. You're making me think of a discussion we had on a recent episode of Streaming Audio about, I think it was when to make things services and when to make things monoliths. You know, how do you decide that? Mm-hmm. And the analogy was to a British economist, 20th century guy named Ronald Coase, who some of his early writing was on the question of why are there companies? And I think this relates mm-hmm. very directly to what you just said. You know, why does everybody, his assumption was, okay, the market is the efficient way to allocate goods and services and resources. Why are we not just using the market all the time? Because like on my team, I'm not putting it on an RFP to build a new slide deck. I'll assign that task and someone will do what I say. There's like this little command economy inside of companies. So why are we not just making everything the market? Well, the answer is because it costs you something to access the market. Like I have to go get light bulbs to buy them, you know, or I have to go get a bid on something and sort through the proposals. And so there's this transaction cost in accessing the market. So these little units of common interest emerge, and we call them companies or firms. And inside those firms, it's this more command sort of organization and not market-driven organization, which is exactly what you just said. You said if the analogy of orchestration is, central command, there can be these little localized areas where, no, it's a good idea to orchestrate these services, and you're not going to get the brittleness of company-scale orchestration. You're not going to get the social problems that arise when one team controls the BPM and ESB system and all that kind of stuff. You won't get that kind of sclerosis. But it's actually smart to do a little bit of central control locally and then let the bigger pieces choreograph.
That makes me think if you want to join giving the talk next time. That's a good analogy.
let's jointly present that somewhere. This would be fun. I can talk about the economics and you could talk about the actual, you could be the person who actually knows things about workflow automation.
But I think it's a very good summary of that. Yes. Yeah. Nice. And the trick is it's, you need both. And that's always the hard answer, because then you have to think of it like on a case by case basis. Hey, what's a better thing to do? It's easier to have a recipe like, hey, we do this all over the place. But it just doesn't work again.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I actually feel a little guilty because I tend to be a choreograph everything fanboy, and I could be forgiven for that.
You have to.
I almost have to, but I guess I'm accepting the correction from you that maybe choreography is the winning solution on the large scale, but let's be adults about this. And yeah, sometimes there are scales in which it doesn't have to be.
I think it's really, it's on a case by case basis. I mean, I think I'm exactly on the opposite side of things. I'm more an orchestration fanboy from my heart, but I think we need both, and somewhere they meet and there are use cases for both.
Yeah. Tell us about, you guys have an open source and or a cloud native workflow engine. Tell us about that.
Right. So yeah. Happy to.
I described it as open source, and correct me if that's wrong. I just realized no, I put those words in there.
It's source available, if you're correct on that. You probably followed the whole discussion about open source licenses. So it's.
I have been involved in one or two of those discussions.
Yes, that's what I think.
And we're so going it's to leave it source.
Time. Yeah, that's what I think. So it's source available. I would say yes, open source, but yeah. Basically a couple of years back already, like 3 or 4 years back, we saw workflow automation being applied to a lot of more use cases. Actually, and like we had a lot of key situations where customers applied it for, let's say, relatively low like workflows that didn't run that often, like account opening, for example. They had that applied there and they said, hey, that's awesome. We really like what we see. Can we apply it to trading? I would ask like, okay, what's the numbers there? And they said like something like 200K per second.
Sure. Said,
we have that SQL database in the background. What should go wrong? So no, it didn't work. It simply didn't work. I mean, that was clear, but it made us think. And what we basically did then is we did a lot of prototypes for different aspects what we need to solve within a workflow engine. And we said, okay, how can we really make that horizontally scalable? That was one of the main goals in the beginning. And over time, it was also like, hey, how can we run that in cloud native environments where we probably don't have a SQL database? Because, I mean, you probably have it in a real cloud again, but if you run on Kubernetes, something like a database, a relational database, is not really easy to operate. So we did that. And then we launched a new project called CB. It's a basically the same thing what we already do. It's a BPMN workflow engine, but now it's really cloud native, horizontally scalable. And yeah, that's also what now fuels what is under what we call Commoner Cloud. So that's a managed offering we provide.
And that's, excellent. Okay, so Commoner Cloud is your cloud version of ZB.
Correct.
And ZB is source available, and there are things one can do with it except make a cloud service out of it, I assume.
Exactly.
Which is wonderful.
Exactly the thing.
yeah. Okay, no, that will most certainly be linked in the show notes. So I would encourage everybody to check that out. That's zeebe.io, zeebe.io.
Right. We even have a Confluent connector for CB.
Yeah. Which segues delightfully into my next question. We haven't really been talking about Kafka, but I think, you know, many listeners know all of these things are very much technologies that are going to expect there to be a Kafka nearby. But mm-hmm. talk to us explicitly about where those integration points happen and if there's anything interesting about them, you know, during your building of ZB and what underlies ZB, like where have the interesting integrations been?
Okay. So, I mean, two things. So the first, like, integration with Kafka from a workflow engine is, I mean, it's relatively clear what you need to integrate. So you probably, a workflow should react on something that's written to a Kafka topic, and a workflow might want to write something to a Kafka topic. That's basically the whole integration.
Very straightforward.
Very straightforward. But you can do a lot with that, actually. And we have a lot of customers using that extensively where they say, okay, we have a lot of events flowing around Kafka, we want to react on that, and starting a workflow, and then probably the workflow writes a command as a record or Kafka or whatever. That works pretty well. And that's also what the connector is kind of doing. I mean, you could do that with simple programming, what we discussed early on, very easy. So if you're in the Java space, it's that's a couple of lines of Java code actually to get it going. But we have the connector to make it even easier for let's say certain target groups, which are at least not feeling that, not feeling that well using Java for this use case. The second thing is like, I mean, CV, there's some special connection between CV and Kafka. I mean, you can do the same thing with Kamuna BPM, but as CV is horizontally scalable, we now get into use cases from the scalability perspective we couldn't do before. And these are very often use cases where Kafka is involved, because Kafka is also obviously used in a lot of like high throughput scenarios. And that make this combination very interesting.
10 years from now, when you're looking back on the successes of workflow automation, I'm sure there'll be some things that didn't work out, and you know, we'll be making jokes about things we're doing now, just like we're making jokes about things we were doing 15 years ago, you know. But when you look back on the successes 10 years from now, what do you think you're going to look back on? What will the world recognize as having been successful?
That's a really a hard question, to be honest. There's so much movement at the moment, but I really hope that we get a good idea on what I said earlier, like what's orchestration, what's choreography, how do we build a really maintainable system out of these pieces, like on the bigger scale. I think we still need to completely understand and learn that as an industry. And then, of course, we need to have the technology and the methodology for that. And I think there is an awesome basis at the moment. I still love things like BPMN. They're totally up to date. And my hope is that this is really get picked up, because at the moment I see so many projects or companies reinventing the wheel there. That starts from big cloud vendors starting own workflow engines, own languages, or the Silicon Valley companies doing own stuff, which is really a pity, because that like it really stops us from moving forward as fast as we could on all these kind of things. And I hope we sort that out and get it going.
My guest today has been Bernd Rucker. Bernd, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you so much, Tim.
And there you have it. I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at @TLBerglund on Twitter. That's @TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to register there. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.